One thing we're getting used to as we follow coronavirus developments is a lot of numbers. The number of cases, the death toll, the number of people filing for unemployment, and on and on. But what are the numbers telling us? Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So you compare the haze of uncertainty that we're in right now and all these numbers with the fog of war. Explain what you mean by that.
So the fog of war is a relatively common term that's used to describe the fact that when a country is fighting a war, it often doesn't know what the heck is going on. It refers to the idea that was once coined by the 19th century Prussian military writer Karl von Clausewitz, that militaries don't understand two things. They don't understand the enemy's threat, and they don't understand their own capacity to combat the enemy. And what I said in this article is that we're experiencing now the fog of pandemic. We are swimming in statistics, infection rates, case fatality ratios, economic data. I mean, turn on the radio, turn on your TV, log online, and you are going to see information and statistics galore. But what I wanted to point out is that all of these statistics are flawed in some way, and it is misleading and sometimes even dangerous to draw too strong conclusions from information that is deeply flawed.
Flawed because, for example, in the case of testing and how many people have the virus, we don't actually test everyone, and so therefore we don't know? Or is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, so I'll give you two examples from public health to start. So first, you look at the international data. There have, for a few weeks, been concerns that the data coming out of China isn't particularly trustworthy. But really, it's just about all the international data. It was just reported that France and Italy haven't typically been including home deaths in their COVID statistics. So all these graphs that we see comparing U.S. death totals to Europe and to China, you know, maybe you should, you know, put a big asterisk over all those numbers, because it's not clear that any particular countries are using the exact same methodology to count COVID deaths. Then you look at the national data. You know, our testing capacity is ramping up really quickly, and that's a great thing. But it's ramping up from a really low number, and it's very uneven across the country. You know, the South, California, New York all have very different standards, very different density of tests, different shares of the population that are being tested. And that means that when you're looking at these all important graph numbers, it's hard to disentangle how much of this is the disease spreading exponentially versus how much of it is the testing increasing exponentially. We just don't quite know yet.
And what about when it comes to the economic numbers? We got that jobless claims report last week that said more than 3 million people had filed for unemployment. Economists are expecting that to go higher. We're going to get the monthly employment report this Friday. Is that going to give us a good sense of what's going on economically?
No, it's really not going to give us a good sense. And it's not the government's fault. It's not the fault of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. You know, the Bureau has this very specific methodology where they do these surveys the week of the 12th of the month. So we're going to get an estimate of the unemployment rate from the week of March 12th. Well, March 12th was the Thursday before many states and cities announced on the following Sunday that they'd be closing all these restaurants and bars. So the unemployment rate that we're going to get this Friday is a measurement of the first 2 weeks of March. But it won't provide an accurate picture of, say, March 29th, March 30th, which is really what economists want to know about. How weak, how strong is the economy right now? And this is really important because one of the critical questions that we have to answer is, how long do we have to live like this? How long do we have to live in self-quarantine? You know, we need good information, good data to understand when we can break this abnormal situation and begin to return to normal. But until we have great data, it will always be very risky to determine when exactly we can break social isolation.
Well, and I think that's what makes this situation even scarier is the uncertainty around it, certainly how long it's going to last, how bad it is going to get, and will we ever be able to go back to what we had before, or is it just going to be something new that we don't know about? What do you think, Derek, will bring this outbreak into better focus?
You know, I've been talking to a lot of economists and public health experts about what is a statistic that would really tell us that our public health capacity is improving in its ability to treat people who have become sick. And one thing they suggested, and this is sort of creative and clever, is what about a survey of frontline healthcare workers in hospitals so that they could essentially tell us, all right, we're beginning to see the curve bend here in front of us. We're seeing fewer cases in New York City or in St. Louis or in Miami, that some kind of survey of healthcare workers might be able to tell us when our capacity to treat people is increasing. And that's where we might be able to see, okay, now we have some indication that the curve is bending and we can look potentially to releasing some people from social isolation and relaxing some of the constraints in the economy that are really important to have right now, but dangerous to enforce over the period of, say, 9 or 12 consecutive months.
That is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.